This is the Medicast, December 10th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 96. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to take a moment and welcome all of you to this podcast. If you are a brand new listener to the Medicast, I want to welcome you to the show. Check out some of the other back episodes, whether you're downloading this through a subscription model or clicking to check on the site over at medicast.com. Either way, you can check out back episodes and also previous posts there on the blog at the Medicast site, all of which is intended to get you more information to make you a better EMS provider in the field. And of course, for all of you long-term listeners, I want to thank you for contributing to the show, for supporting the show, and helping out with all of the things you do to help make the Medicast community what it is today. I want to thank you for that. And I also want to thank you for those of you that have gotten out there and ordered one of the brand new Medicast t-shirts available over at the Medicast store. You can find the store over at store.medicast.com, and I'll have more on that later on in the show. But let's move right on in now to some listener email and find out what questions, comments, and contributions you all have to offer to the show. Listener Ted sent me a question by email about a patient he had on a run recently and has to do with an 82-year-old female that injured her leg in a fall. And we've seen all of these kind of things before. She was found laying on the right side on her back with her knees flexed. She was conscious, alert, and oriented and said that her left leg gave out. She had good distal pulses, motor, and sensory function. However, she did have angulation in the left femur, seemed to be an evident femur fracture. However, she didn't have a lot of pain when she was laying there, only when there was attempted movement. And the question Ted has is, you know, if he can secure her to some kind of a backboard in a recumbent position the way she is, without causing her additional pain and loss of function, does he really need to administer a traction splint in this situation? And that's the question. Traction splint or no traction splint? His thoughts were to place her on the board in the position she was in, try to go ahead and get an IV established, although she really didn't look like she had good IV access on initial assessment, give the patient pain medicine, and continue to transport. He could also maybe have attempted some form of conscious sedation with physician approval to help relax her enough to get the traction splint in place. Ted, this is a tough one, and not having been there, there are a couple of questions I'd want to know. Was this a mid-shaft femur fracture, or was the fracture farther up towards the head of the femur in a position where it's closer to the hip? If it was farther up, more likely to be closer to the head of the fracture, head of the femur and a fracture near the hip, I might be more inclined not to place the traction splint as long as I had good PMS. And the other thing I think is that I kind of agree with you, especially with elderly patients, putting a traction splint on them and then getting them onto a backboard lying in a full supine position is difficult unless you're really careful about padding those voids and getting the patient in a position of comfort. Backboards are extremely uncomfortable. So if we can get this patient in a position that they can be comfortable in without any significant pain while they're still and without any loss of distal pulse motor function, sensory function, I probably might go with what you're saying here is transport her in the position that she's comfortable in. The only thing I would add is that The other thing that the traction splint does, beside positioning the fracture and going ahead and establishing hopefully good pulses in the distal end of the leg, it also does secure the fracture site. And so you're not going to be able to drive down the road without any movement at all. So application of a traction splint might be indicated just to help secure the leg. Or at least find some way to definitely pad around that leg and secure it to some kind of splinting device. Because the splint just doesn't just hold the leg in position to protect against things like loss of distal function. The splints we use, whether there's traction splints or regular padded board splints or a backboard, are all used to hopefully help reduce pain when there is deformity and a possible fracture in place. So those are my thoughts. You know, if you guys have any thoughts as well, I'm going to go ahead and post this over at the MedicCast forums. So you can head over to the MedicCast forums. And because this is a paramedic question as well as a BLS question, I'm going to go ahead and post it over in the BLS section of the forums. Go over and check that category out and add your own thoughts over at forums.medicast.com, and you can find out what other people think about this issue as well. Speaking of forums, I got an interesting comment in from listener Michael. Michael is also a member over at the forums, and he sent me a question regarding the treatment of patients having respiratory distress with pulmonary edema and evident congestive heart failure. And the question he had came directly from the Maryland protocols, which I've linked to in the past. And I actually posted up something about this on the blog this week. So if you haven't been checking out the recent blog posts, I urge you to head over and do that, because I certainly try to keep current information, current questions that come up, and other things that might be of interest to you all over there at the MedicCast blog midweek in between episodes of the podcast. So it's a good way for all of you to find out more about what I'm thinking about and what's going on in EMS over there as well. So Michael had a question about BLS drugs and how they are administered and how they're listed in our protocols, because he was confused by some of the things he saw in the Maryland protocol. And I would just urge you to make sure you check your protocols, and when there is a possible conflict, to check with somebody else. It may not be me necessarily the person to check with, but you can definitely check with your supervisors and your medical directors and find out exactly what something means if it's confusing to you. Michael's question had to do with administration of nitroglycerin and how that related to BLS or ALS providers, as well as the drug captopril, an ACE inhibitor that Maryland allows providers to administer in situations like this to assist the treatment of people with severe pulmonary edema and respiratory distress related to congestive heart failure. So all of this is kind of indicative of the kind of questions that we might have about protocols. And it's one of the reasons I opened up the forums, because I think this is a great opportunity for medical providers from all over the states and all over the world to comment on their particular medical protocols. And we can ask questions of each other, answer those questions, and have a conversation about what we do that is the same and what we do that's different. So check out the forums postings as well on this particular topic and the blog entry I made this week over at MedicCast.com. Remember, if you'd like to leave a comment here on the MedicCast, you can send an email to me at podmedic@mac.com. You can also leave voicemails over at 941-306-3342. And you can leave comments directly at the MedicCast forums at forums.medicast.com. Or you can comment on individual postings over at the MedicCast blog. And just click on the comments link and go ahead and follow the instructions to leave your comment there. All of these ways are great ways to get in touch with me and leave comments for the other listeners of the MedicCast and be informed and in contact with your colleagues out there. Speaking of MedicCast t-shirts, that kind of leads me into this week's link of the week. The next episode of the MedicCast Live is just around the corner, coming up this Tuesday night, December 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. If you would like to have a chance to win your own MedicCast t-shirt, be one of the listeners checking in live that night, and I will give you a special code to email me along with your t-shirt size and address, and I will go ahead and put you in the drawing for that episode's free MedicCast t-shirt, all for just tuning in and listening live to the MedicCast Live. This month, we'll be talking about handling patient refusals and who's in charge. Do we refer and defer to medical directors? Do we defer to patient family? Do we defer to the patient themselves? This is a tough issue and one that's come up and I've reported on and discussed at length on the blog in the past. But there's a lot of questions out there, and we're going to be discussing with each other as well as some of the other MedicCast friends and EMS bloggers out there about exactly what they think of when they think about medical refusals in the field. So that'll be this coming Tuesday night, December 11th at MedicCastLive.com, and that's using the TalkShoe.com meeting engine, and that's a great way for any of us to get together. And I look forward to seeing you all this coming Tuesday night over there at the MedicCast Live at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. It's going to be a great opportunity for all of us to meet together one-on-one with both myself and the other EMS experts that I'll have available for answering this particular question and maybe answering specific questions that you have. As I move on into this week's news, I'll lead off with one of those feel-good stories, and I think it's important for all of us to look at the successes and the examples of exemplary conduct that we run into in our communities, and also make sure we release press releases about it, make sure that the press in our region knows about when one of us has done good. And this story that I found comes out of Wisconsin, where an off-duty paramedic helped deliver a baby as he heard something come over the scanner when he was on his way home from a meeting. And this is a story where a woman was giving birth to her second baby and had to call her mother-in-law because her husband was away on business. And her mother-in-law came over and began to deliver the baby with the help of the online dispatch system while they had an ambulance en route. And another paramedic by the name of Edwin Lacrosse was listening and understood that the ambulance was not going to get there in time based on his understanding of their transport distance. And he happened to be in the region. He pulled over into the neighborhood, got out, and assisted the mother-in-law with completing the birth process, assessing the baby. He used a turkey baster from the kitchen to go ahead and clear the airway with suction and was able to get the baby all wrapped up in warm towels and ready for transport when the ambulance finally did arrive. They used a shoelace to tie off and clamp the cord. Everything was all squared away. And so this is one of those things, you know, when you have something like this happen in your community, one of your associates, your partners, somebody else you know does good or has success in the field that isn't directly related to work but is using their EMS skills, it holds up all of us as an example of why people think we should be held as heroes in their eyes. And it's because we go above and beyond. We understand what's going on, and we put ourselves out there, even when we're not working, to assist people. It's what we do. And this is one of those instances where one of us does really well and gets recognized by the community at large, and it lifts all of us up in the public's eyes. So when you see something like this, get it out into your public media in your local area. Go ahead and get a press release or talk to your supervisors about it, because this needs to be recognized when something like this or any other exemplary action goes on. Then it raises all of our esteem in the public eye. And I think this is a good thing. So kudos go out to Edwin, and from both myself and from, I know, the MedicCast listeners. Since I'm talking about births, I'll use that as a segue of sorts into the next story, which has to do with a recent Centers for Disease Control report on the increase in teen pregnancies from 2005 to 2006. Now, this increase has been alarming some researchers, although it's too early to tell according to the officials at the CDC, whether this is a single year blip in the survey data where it's just a normal statistical anomaly, or whether it really is the beginning of an increase in teen births. This is the first time that birth rates have increased in 15 years. And I think that's why it's kind of startled some people. A 3% increase could be somewhat significant when you look at the number of teens having children every year. And there has been some controversy around it as to whether this is because of recent years' increased federal funding for abstinence-only health education that doesn't teach teens how to stop having children when they have sex anyway. But this is not sure. So rather than just get involved in that whole controversy, and I've talked about some of those issues on other news items, I will, however, use this as a reminder to all of us to make sure we're ready for a birth like Edwin came across. What are we going to do if we find out our ambulance doesn't have its maternity kit? And what else do we have in our kits to use to cover us if we don't have the proper equipment handy? Or if we're on our way home or off work and come upon a situation where we have to deliver a baby, we need to be prepared to use the items at hand. This is something we're very good at. We're very good at being creative and being able to adapt and overcome when we have challenges like that. But it is important for us to think about it and plan ahead, no different than planning for a mass casualty incident. Part of the same article also focused on another expected increase in the number of unwed mothers having children. And this was expected. That number has been rising at a predictable rate based on several societal factors. But it does also mean that there's going to be less assistance. Unwed mothers may not have a ready partner or a caregiver handy. And in those instances, that person is going to be more likely to call an ambulance for help when they don't have a ride to the hospital with someone else. Now, that may be stereotyping by me, but again, we need to be prepared and we need to understand that it may not be a husband all the time with the patients we transport. It may be a neighbor. It may be another relative. It may be just a bystander. And we might not want to embarrass ourselves by automatically assuming that the man standing next to the patient is indeed her husband. In the leadoff story tonight, I talked about an EMT or paramedic stopping to assist a patient that maybe occurs maybe when you're not on duty. And, you know, I end every show with the same thing, scene safety, BSI. But this particular story that I'm going to cover next has to do with why we really need to be aware of our surroundings and really engage in safe scene practices. Now, this is just an unfortunate occurrence that happened, but it does remind us all to be very aware of what's going on around us and make sure that we operate safely. The story I'm talking about comes from a story I found dealing with an EMT who stopped with his wife to assist a teenage driver who had spun her car around on an icy road. And when the EMT and his wife got out, along with a tractor-trailer driver who also stopped, another car spun out of control and struck the EMT that was stopped to assist the driver. And this is something that we just, you know, it's a fluke accident. It happens. You know, it's one of those things that people are going to run into when we have this kind of a situation. The roads were icy. They were unsafe to begin with. Other drivers aren't paying as good of attention to the road conditions as they should. If one driver spun out, you can be sure that somebody else somewhere else on the road is going to do the same thing, especially on a busy interstate. And this is what happened in this situation. And I'm not saying that this particular person didn't do what needed to be done. Both he and his wife are both volunteer firefighters and EMTs. They were known to the local sheriff's department that they were usually the first people on the scene, even when they were on duty. In this situation, they saw the driver spin out, stopped immediately to assist, and unfortunately, the EMT by the name of Raymond Christensen was struck by another motorist and is in critical condition as a result of the injuries sustained. And again, we have to remember that when we don't practice scene safety, and again, I want to be stressing here, this could be one of those things where no matter what he could have done, this would have ended up badly. But, you know, we need to just be ever more aware of what's going on around us and keep that extra eye focused on our backs and watching ourselves. Because what happens when one of us goes down from an injury at the scene? The patient, the heck with them, right? Everybody all of a sudden worries about the injured EMT, injured paramedic, injured firefighter, and their eyes come off the patient, or at least some aspect of their attention comes off the patient as they're worried about how their friend and colleague is doing. So my thoughts and prayers, and I know yours as well, are with Raymond Christensen and his wife as he deals with his injuries as a result of this incident, and hope for a speedy recovery. But it is an opportunity for a lesson to be learned by all of us. Not that we don't stop and help, because that's not something I'm saying at all, but that when we do stop and help, especially when we're in a private vehicle without the benefit of flashing lights, a large truck backing us up, possibly other equipment arriving at the same time to help out, is when we're by ourselves, we need to really go that extra mile towards scene safety and really just try to be more aware, and maybe it'll help us avoid these kinds of situations. Again, I'm not saying that Raymond didn't do the right thing. This may have happened regardless anyway, but it is certainly a lesson for all of us to keep in the back of our mind when we do stop and help somebody, maybe to approach it in a different way or think more about what other traffic on the road is doing at the time. Finally, I will wrap up the news today with a story on how we learn from our mistakes. You ever had one of those people you've known, or maybe it's a regular patient you transport, that you just shake your head and go, you know, this is the guy that's always doing X. This is the guy that's always getting in trouble because he wasn't thinking about what he was going to do and didn't learn from his or her mistakes, right? This is what we do. That we run into these people all the time. Maybe you're one of those people where you really have to beat your head against the wall a few times before you figure out something. It may not be all your fault. It may, in fact, be a genetic change in the way your gene makeup is. And in fact, you have fewer receptors for certain neurotransmitters in your brain. And this is why you have a harder time learning from negative feedback. A study was conducted where they actually looked at patients who had a certain gene marker that showed that they had fewer dopamine receptors than other people based on this particular gene combination on their chromosomes. And what happened was that the German researchers involved found that the men with the gene change actually had a harder time learning from negative feedback. The study was conducted pretty simply. They had letter combinations where they had A, B, C, D, E, F, and others that appeared. When they chose the correct letter, such as A, C, or E from that combination, a smiley face came up and a scowling face came up when they made an incorrect choice. And then they were showed new pairs of letters. And over time, they would learn by the process of positive or negative feedback that they were able to select the right letter because they figured out the pattern. They figured out the situation. However, it took longer, more negative feedback reactions for the men with the gene aberration or the gene change, that they were unable to as quickly make the determination that this was a problem. This may be what's going on in some people who seem to be always involved in risk-taking behaviors. Maybe their first incidents of a risk-taking behavior where they were injured and hurt themselves, they didn't get the picture. They didn't get the message, and so they didn't realize that it wasn't okay to continue doing that. So they went back and they tried it again. The researchers don't have any firm evidence of this, but they say it may shed light on other risky habits, like people who become addicted, who use narcotics or other illegal drugs, who engage in other illegal activities or negative, societally negative activities based upon the fact that they may have a reduced ability to learn from the negative feedback. Now, it doesn't say that they can't learn from the negative feedback. It just says that it takes them a little longer to get it through their head. You know, has anyone ever said, when's it going to get through your thick head? When are you going to figure this out? Well, it may be that some people take a few extra tries before they figure out that something isn't the right way to do it. And sometimes that's just the way it is. Sometimes you need to learn those things for yourself and it actually sticks better. So, but it's an interesting study on how we learn from mistakes, and it may give you or somebody else insight into how a patient's working, how yourself deals with certain situations, or how you learn in your school environments. And you may need to change the way you evaluate things if you think you might fall into this particular category. And I think that's enough. We'll wrap up the news with how we learn from mistakes. The news is now over, and I'll move right on into this week's tip and trick of the week. And it has to do with some of the things we talked about this week: scene safety, making sure that we are learning from our mistakes and learning from the mistakes of others, and being able to take care of ourselves in the field. I end each episode with scene safety BSI because I want us to be aware of things like being safe and being aware of our surroundings on the scene and making sure we're taking universal precautions with our body substance isolation. And so I think it's a good thing for me to revisit scene safety periodically. I've found some great resources and have linked to them in the show notes for this episode. And of course, if you're receiving the Medicast newsletter, you will get the show notes with all those links sent directly to your email. So that's a reason to sign up for the newsletter if you haven't done so already. One resource that I use quite a bit is a booklet published by the U.S. Fire Academy, a division of the United States Federal Emergency Management Agency. The U.S. Fire Administration, USFA, is a great resource for anything related to rescue, EMS, fire operations, and there's a ton of information available on their site. This particular booklet is called EMS Safety Techniques and Applications, and it looks at everything from universal precautions to scene safety to maintaining your own personal health, both dealing with stress, dealing with injuries, and then wraps up with a great section for management. A great section if you're a supervisor or want to be a supervisor in EMS. I would highly urge you to download this PDF. It's a great resource for you, and there's a whole section in there on what your responsibilities need to be with regard to your staff. How are you going to keep them safe in the field? How are you going to educate them about safety in the field? Like I said, this booklet is huge. It's hundreds of pages, but I'm going to be looking specifically at scene safety, what you do on the scene that can help protect you from bad things that might happen. And this is something, you know, we get kind of complacent. All right, we go to the same neighborhood all the time. We're in a region where we know, oh, this is so-and-so's house. Well, you can't be complacent. Maybe it's so-and-so's house, but so-and-so's not home. Maybe it's so-and-so's house, but so-and-so's moved, and somebody else lives there now. You have to really be aware of these kind of things all the time. Even when you've gotten into your groove and have developed your own system, you still need to keep scene safety awareness in the forefront of your practice in the field. Scene safety starts off with dispatch information. And we all know that the dispatch job is difficult. Try to understand what's going on in a stressful situation where people are crying, yelling, and screaming over the phone. You're going to try to get the best information you can to pass it on to the provider on the street and hope that the information is correct when they get there. And maybe you'll amend it. Maybe you'll be able to update it with better information while they're en route, but that may not necessarily be the case. That understood, you still can try to glean some information based on the dispatch data that you get. So you're going to start off there. If you're getting called for an injured person, what's the first question that comes to your mind? What injured the person? How did they get hurt? You know, there's a lot of difference between a guy who, you know, slipped on an icy step and broke his leg and a guy who met up with a couple of guys in a dark alley and got stabbed. He's still in that dark alley and the other guys might still be around. Okay. What is the injury? What is the age of the person? It's less likely in some cases for a very young child to be a threat to you, but if you have a health otherwise expected to be healthy individual of, you know, an adult age between the ages of, say, 20 and 60, you're going to want to maybe be more wary of what you might expect when you get there. So you want to start building an impression based on dispatch data, but you don't want to become complacent about that either, because the next step is your arrival on the scene. And this is your period of greatest vulnerability. And this is the words directly out of that report that I'm talking about. You are visible to other people. You're getting out of your unit. If it's nighttime, you are backlit. So you're night vision is being blinded by your unit's lights as you open up cabinets and get equipment out. And you're in perfect position to be attacked if that is indeed someone's intent at the scene. So before anything else happens, the first question you need to ask yourself when you get on the scene is, am I even going to want to get out of the ambulance? Okay? That means you're going to assess the scene as you roll up to it, start a block or two blocks away. You know, if you're driving down the street and there's a crowd of people running the other direction, maybe there's something else going on here. Usually people, bystanders, want to see what's going on, are curious about what's happening. But if they're running the other way, that may be an indicator to you that something bad is happening up ahead. And it might be time to call and find out if there's police assistance on the scene or en route. So that's one thing you want to look for. You also want to look for other items that may be of interest to you. Again, what are road conditions like? What is the lighting like? If it's nighttime, is this a well-lit area or is it a poorly lit residential area? If you're on a major highway, what's the traffic conditions like? What is the situation with regard to traffic control? Is there a highway patrolman, state police officer, somebody like that there who's waving traffic out of the lane that your accident is in? What do you need to do to protect yourself better? What direction do you need to be heading to get away? If you're going into a neighborhood that has a cul-de-sac, you want to go by the house, turn the ambulance around, and come back so you're facing out of the development. This way, you can escape. If you run and retreat to your ambulance and start to drive away and you're driving into a cul-de-sac, you've got nowhere to go. You're on a dead-end street, and you've got to drive back past the dangerous area. So be aware of those kind of things. What about animals? What about other safety issues? Is it a construction scene? That means that there's parts of the building that aren't complete that may collapse. Is it a ditch where there's going to be trench collapse involved? All of these things are things you need to keep in the back of your mind as you approach the scene and start viewing what the scene looks like. Most of the time, help is requested and they want you to be there. But in the case of assault, you always need to be aware of where is the person who committed the assault. These people may have wanted to cause injury and are making sure that that injury has the desired effect, maybe to kill the person. And if you show up, you're going to thwart their evil plan. Okay, I know that sounds funny, but you know, you got to think in those regards. Somebody wanted to hurt this person. You're showing up to help them. Then you are now not achieving what they wanted to achieve. And so they could be angry at you. They could decide that you're getting in the way of their solution to whatever problem they had that caused them to shoot, stab, assault, or otherwise beat this person. And therefore, you deserve to be shot, stabbed, assaulted, or beaten. So you need to be aware of that. So before you even get out of the unit, you need to start thinking about these considerations. When you do get to the scene, don't back into the driveway. Again, pull in a situation where you can leave the neighborhood, leave the scene safely, and get away if you have to. And also, when you back in, you lose the ability to visualize what's going on at the scene. So pull in so you can see what's going on when you get there. So as you approach the scene, as you leave your ambulance, as you enter the home, you want to be thinking about retreat. How can you get out of the house? Note things like, oh, there's the back door. There's the door to the garage. This is a long hallway I've got to leave. If I'm in this back bedroom, I need to make sure I don't leave my bag behind me where I can trip over it if I have to leave or back up in a hurry. These are all things you need to keep in mind, okay? You're going to carry your bag in front of you when you get in, okay? The bag makes an excellent shield. It's a great thing to kind of hand off to somebody if they start coming at you. Shove it at them. Make them grab a hold of the heavy EMS bag, and then you can turn and get the heck out of Dodge. Remember this, and this is a quote directly from the document that I'm citing here. When a scene is dangerous, the EMS provider is justified in leaving. Suppressing dangerous situations is a law enforcement task and is not the task of pre-hospital emergency medical service personnel. Okay? I can't spell it out any more clearly than that. It is not our job to be heroes to the point that we run in the middle of gunfire and drag somebody to safety. I know that we'd all like to be that guy, but all too often that guy ends up dead. And that's just that simple. Okay, there's a lot of dead heroes out there. I'd rather be the guy that goes home alive to my family at the end of the day. And if I can save somebody's life because I waited till the appropriate time to go in there and get them out and apply my superior medical knowledge to saving their life when I do get access to them in a safe way, then that's what I'll do. And I can be that kind of hero all day long. As you approach the patient or bystanders, people who called EMS, and you begin to start to talk to them, and you're going to go through your spiel and introduce yourself, you want to assess their body language. Are they nervous? Do they seem like they're not acting normally? There are a lot of things you can do just in the back of your mind, because we're so good at reading things like body posture and facial expression, just because that's the nature of being a human being. We can look for things like outward emotions that they're just not right. You know, if somebody is completely freaking out beyond what's expected based on the information you have, then you need to assume that the information is wrong. If you get called because somebody has a bloody nose and you show up and somebody is completely freaking out off the board about this bloody nose, you need to start wondering, wait a minute, what happened? How did this bloody nose occur? Okay. Read their facial expression. Are they angry? Do they show fear? Try to discover why, and you may find out that somebody is around that is of danger to that person. They may be angry because they think you took too long to get there. There are a lot of reasons why people react the way they do to us, and we can read that assessment, make that assessment of what's going on based just on how they look when we walk up to them. We need to be open. We need to be honest with our patients, because if you lie to the patient, you've lost their trust, and they're not going to let you treat them anymore, and they're going to be angry when they're hurt and they can't be treated successfully. Okay, I've talked about arrival on the scene and arrival with the patient. So now what do? We're now with the patient, and we're going to start beginning our assessment. We're going to be asking our questions. We're going to be getting our vital signs. We're going to be doing all the things we do in an initial assessment and then follow-up assessments. This is another critical time where we begin to get that tunnel vision, because we've got to start focusing in on the one patient's injuries, where we are not paying attention to our surroundings adequately. If you're by yourself, this is extremely important for us to arrange ourselves in a position where we can try to view entrances to the room. Also, make sure that we keep the exit lane available for ourselves if we have to retreat. If you have a partner there with you, or if there are other emergency responders on the scene, you can delegate the responsibility for scene oversight to somebody else. Hey, you know what? Can you just stand here and keep an eye on things and answer questions, but make sure that, you know, we're keeping an eye on what's going on? You can do that. Or if you work with somebody all the time and your partner knows that the person doing the assessment is focused on the patient and the person that's there getting general medical information from bystanders is responsible for paying attention to the scene a little bit more. It doesn't take it off the person doing the assessment to try to keep an extra eye out, but at least you have a partner there you can trust to watch your back. Then you have that extra pair of eyes for yourself. And that's important as well. One of the most important pieces of safety equipment that we carry is our portable radios. And if you don't have portable radios, then the radio in your unit. You want to make use of this when needed to summon assistance, whether it's because you're in the middle of a hazmat incident and wasn't aware of it until you arrived, or if you're in the middle of a violent situation and you need police assistance. Either way, you can use your radio to call for assistance. And so it's important that you understand appropriate radio procedures for your region, for your agency, and that you develop a rapport with your dispatchers. Radios are not a place to be joking around or fooling around with. You need to be using your radios professionally all the time so that your dispatchers will understand when you call for help and it's more than a stressful situation that this is unusual for you and this is a cause for alarm. Also, there are some radios that possess emergency response features and other situations that may be particular to your agency. So I urge you to check with your supervisors, your medical director, and other people in your agency about what specific scene safety measures are used in your particular region. This is something you probably were educated about maybe a long time ago when you first joined the agency. Maybe it was part of an in-service training class when changes were made and you didn't make that particular class because you were on vacation. Either way, this is something you don't need to be aware of and understand exactly how your particular region, agency, or jurisdiction handles this particular problem and how you can call for help if you need to. And that's a little look at arrival scene safety and approaching the patient safely. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about some other topics of scene safety in a future episode of the MedicCast. In the meantime, I'm interested in hearing back your comments on this particular topic, and maybe we can make this a topic of interest for a future episode of the MedicCast Live, where we can share particular scene safety stories and get scene safety questions answered. I'll move right on into this week's Med of the Week. And I was talking a little bit about suicide prevention and depressive illnesses during the holiday season. So I'm going to look at another medication that you may find being used to treat patients with problems with depression or bipolar disorder. And that drug is lithium. Now, lithium is technically an anti-manic agent and is usually used to treat or prevent episodes of mania in people with bipolar disorders or other abnormal mood-altering situations. They may also be used for things like depression, schizophrenia, or disorders of impulse control, as well as certain mental illnesses that may be found in children. It also is used to treat certain blood disorders as well. So because this is prescribed for many uses, just because a patient is taking lithium may not mean that they have a behavioral problem. It may be an indication that something else is going on. But we're going to talk mainly about its primary prescription reason, which is for patients with bipolar disorder or other behavioral issues. Lithium is a medication that is taken in tablet form, and so with any kind of tablet medication taken by somebody, you want to get an assessment of how frequently they're taking their medication. Are they taking it on a regular schedule? Lithium is a drug that needs to be maintained in a very narrow range of therapeutic value in the bloodstream, and so most patients who take lithium should be receiving regular blood testing to make sure that their lithium levels are not rising to a dangerous level or have fallen below a therapeutic level in their system. And so this is something you can kind of ask them. Have you been tested recently to make sure your lithium levels are okay? This is a way for you to assist in maintaining their health. Maybe they are not seeing you for a behavioral problem, but you notice they're taking lithium. You want to find out if they're taking it regularly and also if they have been getting their regular blood testing so that they can maintain a safe level in the blood. Because drug concentrations are very important in maintaining safe levels of lithium in the blood, there are medications that can have some very severe side effects when combined with lithium use. So you want to make sure you're checking when you get a patient that's taking lithium, are they taking any kind of blood pressure medications, any kind of diuretic medication, or any kind of combination medication for those two things? And the reason being is that these medications affect the blood pressure and the same things that affect the blood pressure generally affect the way the kidneys excrete fluids. And because lithium is excreted from the kidneys, anything that alters the way the kidneys work is likely to alter the levels of lithium in the blood, either causing them to remain increased because they're over-concentrating or causing lithium levels to decrease by under-concentrating the lithium in the blood. Either way, they're going to be excreting either too much or too little lithium, and these medications could cause that effect. And I'm talking about medications like ACE inhibitors, some of the calcium channel blockers, as well as your diuretics like hydrochlorothiazide, and even diuretics like furosemide, although furosemide is likely to have less of an effect according to some reports. I think all diuretics should be held with caution until they can be examined by a physician and looked at the number of meds that the patients are taking. So you want to ask when new meds have been added, and if they're taking blood pressure medication, find out how they are handling that and how their recent blood testing has been for their lithium levels. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or other medications like Aleve all can have an effect on the way that patients handle their lithium doses. And this is because these medications also tend to block the excretion of the lithium from the body. So if a patient's been under a lot of pain lately, you want to find out what medications they're taking to handle that pain, as they may be experiencing some toxic levels of lithium as a result of taking a lot of NSAIDs over the last few days. So that also needs to be monitored. Common side effects associated with taking lithium include minor hand tremors, dry mouth, a change in the way you perceive taste, also weight gain, increased thirst, increased urination, as well as mild nausea or vomiting, and a decreased libido. So these are things that may occur that are normal side effects. There are also some toxic side effects. In other words, signs that the lithium levels may be too high and approaching toxic levels. A loss of appetite, visual impairment, onset of tiredness, muscle weakness, muscle twitching, that's broad in scope. In other words, not just maybe some minor tremors, but some actual twitches visible frequently to a bystander. Also, extended tremors, unsteady gait, confusion. They may actually have seizures as a result of toxic levels of lithium, and heart arrhythmias, slurred speech, and possibly even coma. Also, about 1 in every 25 people who takes lithium may develop a goiter as a result of hypothyroidism. Now, this is an enlarged thyroid gland, would be noticed as a swelling around the front of the neck, and you would feel a enlarged thyroid gland there. Signs of hypothyroidism include dry, rough skin, hair loss, hoarse voice, mania, mental depression, and increased sensitivity to cold, as well as swelling of the feet, lower legs, and neck. All of these could be signs of hypothyroidism related to lithium use. So that's just an overview of the medication lithium and some of the things we might encounter when having a patient with lithium in the field or in the hospital. And this is an opportunity for you to learn a little bit more about that particular medication as the med of the week. And I think that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show, and I urge you to get back in touch with me with any comments or questions or even corrections that you might have. Remember, I learn as much from you guys as you all learn from me, and I certainly appreciate it when you bring new information to my attention. It's a great way for me to share that information back with the other listeners, and we all have different things that we have had contact with and learned from that we can share back with the other listeners. So you can do that by a couple of different ways. You can reach me by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also catch up with me via the voicemail line. That's 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And you can also check out and leave information for each other over at the brand new MedicCast forums at forums.mediccast.com. Head on over there and sign up, register for yourself, and you can get access to the MedicCast forums, open up a new discussion, contribute to ongoing discussions over there, all at the MedicCast forums. A great way for listeners to keep in touch with each other and carry on an ongoing conversation about the topics covered each week in the MedicCast, as well as a whole lot more. If you haven't already done so, make sure you get signed up for the MedicCast newsletter. We're rapidly approaching the second anniversary of the show, and I will be giving away some great things, some MedicCast t-shirts, I have MedicCast water bottles, I'll have some other items that I'll have to give away, all coming up the first week of February, the second anniversary of the MedicCast. And the way I find out who gets that stuff is I go ahead and select randomly from the email list. So if you're on the MedicCast email list, you want to make sure that you get yourself on there so that you can be in the running for great stuff. And on top of that, you also get the show notes emailed to you every week. Great way for me to stay in contact with you when other things are coming up, like next week's MedicCast Live. And it's a great way for you to stay informed about what's going on with the MedicCast. There's a link in the show notes in the upper right-hand corner of the website page. All of those places, great ways to sign up for the MedicCast newsletter, and then you'll get all of this information sent directly to you by email. I'll close out, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. Keeping in the holiday theme that I've been running here for the last few weeks, I will end with a song from a band called Basic with the great Christmas carol, Joy to the World. They have their own unique take on it, so you'll have to listen in and see what you think. If you like what you hear, get back to the band. I have a link in the show notes, and you can also check out their music over at iTunes, and there's a link and a button to click in the show notes as well if you'd like to head on over and purchase their music. Great stuff, and I guess I'll let them wrap it all up. In the meantime, I want to remind all of you, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and the rest of you need to remember, scene safety, BSI.
Yeah. truth and